Hi, everyone out there. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Nick Gray. I'm going to quickly try to explain what I'm doing, why I'm doing this, because if you're listening, good chance you're a friend or a family or a person linked on my LinkedIn that might be interested. But beyond that, if you're listening and you don't know who I am, I'm obsessed with winning and in the sense of I just love the art of constructing a win, whether it's in sport or in business or in lots of other ways you can do that. Essentially achieving your dreams, setting a target and achieving that target, achieving the goal. So I've started writing a book about it and I've got various chapters. My idea is that I'm going to interview interesting people who've achieved huge things in their lives and hopefully get their philosophy on winning a little bit and how they get there, how they construct that process to achieve those goals. So that's the concept of the podcast. Maybe I bleed it into some other things depending on which way it goes. Fairly free flow. I love these long form conversations. I love the opportunity to get interesting people in and talk to them. My first guest is someone I really wanted to get on this thing and I'm so happy. I'm going to introduce him in a second. But if any of you are interested in talking to me, any of you are interested in having a conversation, a longer form conversation around this topic or anything else, really, we can just shoot it, then get in touch. I'm always keen to meet interesting people. I'm always keen to have interesting conversations and learn and improve. With no further ado, I introduce you to the first podcast. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Here I am with a person I call Uncle John. He's actually my mum's cousin. And I'm super excited. This is the first podcast, hopefully of many, that I'm going to be doing. I have an intent to do many. So let's get on this. But I'm so happy right now because I have Uncle John here with me and he is legitimately one of the most inspirational people I've ever met in my life. He is a massive inspiration to me personally and has inspired me to take on a number of challenges. He's a constant adventurer. He has, and we're going to hear about some of those adventures hopefully in a bit. And he's also an incredible man for lifting people up and he actually makes a career of it. So he runs a company called Tiger Teams. He's an executive coach. He coaches teams and leadership teams and all sorts of other people as well from all walks of life. He takes them on adventures and has them put outside their comfort zone to really test themselves in what they do. And obviously he comes with a huge background of experience. He worked in the Metropolitan Police. He worked in the army. He has a number of like many years of experience doing all this leadership training. Again, we're going to hear about that in a minute, but all of that packages together to make this incredible guy. And I'm so happy that he's agreed to come on my podcast. And if it's sponsored by anyone, it's sponsored by him, because he's doing it free of charge. So I super appreciate, John, you being here. And I'm going to sort of get you to talk a little bit about yourself. But one of the things I wanted to mention was you've spent your career lifting people up and kind of like finding the best in people and helping people to achieve their goals, their dreams. But by nature, then it makes you a little bit humble, but you've done some incredible things, which I know you're happy to talk about. And I want you to kind of peel off a little bit of that humble and let's have a bit of a free conversation about, you know, some of the amazing things you have done and let's acknowledge them as amazing. And what I want to do, so the main theme of this podcast series hopefully is around this winning concept, how to construct a win, how to win. And winning can be defined in so many different ways, as you and I have already discussed. But the last chapter of my book is called Be Brave and Execute. And I think you encapsulate that for me. So that's what I wanted to start at the beginning with the podcast, at the end with the book. So the last chapter is Be Brave and Execute. I figure you're my best shot at having a very, very interesting conversation around that theme. But of course, we can talk about all sorts of other stuff as well. So with that in mind, John, I wanted to kind of pass over to you just to, if you can, briefly introduce yourself and around what you've done in your life. Well, you don't have to be brief, actually. We can talk for ages if you want, but talk about what you've done, talk about your experiences and where, what got you to today. I know every leadership development training, you probably do this. You say, right, let's talk around the room. Let's introduce ourselves. I want you to spend a bit longer than you're doing those meetings to sort of talk about what you've done.
Sure, man. Okay, that's great. I guess I was born with a very restless spirit. And I'm not sure that when I was young I was very brave. I was a complete and utter coward, I think, when I was young. So much so that my father sent me off to boarding school to toughen me up, you know, which was a bit alarming, really. I don't know if people still do that, but
did it work? Was it the boarding school?
I think it was survival, not anything. But I was very, very moved by the influence that my father had on me. He was a very successful man in his own life, and had done many courageous things during the war, and you know, his job was, you know, was extraordinary. And when I was a little boy, I used to go into his bed and listen to stories of the things he'd done. And I used to think, oh my God, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful one day if I could just, you know, be like that, if I could actually do some of the stuff that he's done, you know, it was great. But, you know, I then went into the sort of funnel of, you know, going off to school and doing all that kind of stuff. And then eventually I was lucky enough to join the army and became a young army officer. Where they're in the army, one thing they're very good at is helping you to be courageous, because you pretty much have to be, you know. And actually, as a young army officer, you're meant to always be leading from the front. So, you know, you've got to lead the charge on stuff. So if you're in whether you're in the remote jungle of Belize or whatever it is, you're expected to kind of set the path forward, you know, and that was quite formative for me, I think. And certainly that's when I started climbing big mountains and volcanoes and jungles and God knows what, you know. And then when I left after doing my 3 years or whatever it was, short service commission, I thought, really, I don't know very much about life, and maybe what I need to do is to find out a bit more. So I thought if I became a policeman in London, you know, I could learn a bit. And sure enough, I did. I joined up as a PC in the late 1960s, where things were a bit different in London, perhaps those. And in those days, and I learned a lot, you know. But I became frustrated because the leadership wasn't quite what I was used to, you know, in the army. And I just wanted to get to a place where I could actually try and find out how can you lead people to do things that they wouldn't perhaps normally do. You know, how can you lead them to get excited about stretch assignments? And I was very lucky because I was able to run a big police station in the late 1960s. In troubled times where we had riots and, you know, as we were seen as like the Gestapo in occupation, I think, in those days. So my job was to try and help change the culture, you know, within the organisation and try and win some friends in a very hostile community. And that got me fascinated by the whole leadership piece. And indeed, I went on to spend the rest of my life, you know, looking at it, trying to understand it, trying to help other people develop their own style of leadership in a way that was going to be really effective. But it seemed to me as a part of that, that if I was going to have any credibility, I really ought to put myself under the same sort of pressure. And therefore, I really need to stretch myself. And I needed to look for opportunities to stretch myself that were unusual. And so I ended up taking people into the Himalayas, climb unclimbed peaks and getting some near-death experience, which are very, very, pretty scary at the time. But actually, they really do hone you. It's a bit like the anvil of life or something, you know, they forge you into something. And each time you go to the ultimate stretch, you know, to the very edge of what you feel is your capability, somehow you come out different. And each time it kind of excites you and makes you want to try the next thing.
And you were always chasing that, right, Uncle John? I know you, always chasing that next thing. But it's wonderfully, I mean, although there's a risk of death, There is a very positive sideline to it, which is you achieve these incredible life adventures and have so much more to build from that, I guess. And that's what you've done time and time again.
Well, you know, yeah, I think it's each time you come back a little dented probably, but perhaps a little bit wiser, you know. Probably if you had any wisdom, you wouldn't go again. So when it was that I ended up writing a book a couple, 2 or 3 years ago, and I was trying to collect together the various different crazy things that we've been doing. And people said, you know, the guy who's writing with me said, or helping me write it, he said, John, I've just got a name for the book, you know. Why don't we call it Restless? Asking, Restless? Do you think that's a good title? And I said, and I spoke to my wife, I said, he wants to call the book Restless. what do you think? She said, oh my God, that's you.
Nailed it. You are Restless. Yeah. Well, Auntie Elaine, as I call her, she is one patient lady. Yeah, but you're living with this restless man. But great that you fed that restless nature as well. I think if I can rewind you slightly, because I think that was, I mean, I'd like to dig a little deeper. I mean, you talked about the police and the riots in the time you were there. But if you could maybe talk a little bit more around that, because obviously, not everyone knows about that. I mean, I know that there was a really rough time in London at that time, but I don't know much about it. So if you could maybe, especially given that in this day, right now, you know, there's a lot of issues, especially in the States around policing and all of that. You know, where did you find yourself in your, as a young police officer out of the army, right? I mean,
yeah.
You can talk to me a bit about that.
I guess really, if I focus on, I was lucky because I worked in some place like Notting Hill and, you know, and on the Harrow Road in London, you know, some places that were very troubled times when I was a young PC, and we weren't always very good at doing our job in those days. I think we were pretty much out of touch with the thinking nowadays. So when I actually came to take over the police station at Stoke Newington, and it was a very difficult time. There were very different tensions there. There were people who worked, who were brilliant working for me, who, not working for me, but working for the organisation, who were, their big thing was they wanted to go out and arrest people. That was the thing that was really most important thing in their life. then there were the sort of neighbourhood police officers who were trying to get peace in the area, you know, trying to sort of settle things down a bit. And then I'd go to numerous community meetings and, you know, as the top guy, imagine I walk in with all this silver braid and everything, and the local community used to give me some real stick. You know, they really used to go for me big time. I was like their sort of sitting duck to have a go. And I had to work out eventually, who am I working for here? What am I trying to do? And I think it really, that's when I think we get into that whole business around clarity of goal. You know, what is it that we're trying to achieve? Mm-hmm. And for me, well, yes, I was working for my officers who I loved dearly. And however bit misguided they might have been at times, it was basically they had a good spirit. They were trying to do what they thought was the best thing, you mm-hmm. know. In being honest themselves, I think, in what they were trying to do, very often putting their life on the line to do it. Then there was the sort of the community, which was very varied, you know, from the kind of the Orthodox Jews in one part of the place, and then there were, you know, different parts of the community. Then you had the dyed-in-the-wall sort of white East End community. Then you have the Afro-Caribbeans on the front line, the drug dealers, who were really running the show, you know, and it became very clear to me. So who was that? We now had my senior officers above me who were demanding this, that, and the other, and, you know, constantly sort of calling us to meetings. I just think, who am I working for? And I worked out, actually, I'm working for peace, really. If I can just work for peace, that's a pretty good thing. Whatever it takes, I'll do it.
So it's a pretty good mission, right?
Yeah, well, it's an easy target to go for. And I think that's, for all of us, whatever we're trying to do, it's very difficult. You've got to remove the clutter somehow. And the clutter very often comes from people above you who don't really quite understand, you know, what you're doing, what you're trying to do. And they don't always get it, really, because they're not enmeshed in it in the way you are on the sort of grassroots level. And so I think it's really important to try, but you've obviously got to deal with them because they're up there and they're kind of controlling the budgets. And, you know, and sack you.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
But then, you know, then you've got to try and lift the people who are working with you and get them excited about your mission.
Yeah.
Because you may have your dream, but if it's not their dream, you're wasting your time. And so very often you're trying to sell them something, you know.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the pieces of advice I give to a lot of people who I've been the manager of, I've said, manage your manager, but I say it to everyone because you've got to manage upwards as well as downwards. And if you're not managing your situation and understanding what their needs and wants are and trying to achieve that as well, then you're really not going to be performing as a team effectively. But how often you must come across it all the time. I also have in business, you know, this feeling of like, they don't understand. They have no idea what's really going on the floor. They don't understand what it's really like to take these phone calls or to face these customers or whatever it is. And you hear this all the time. And I think to myself, yeah, but they if they've got there and they actually care about their job and they care about the performance of the business or organization or, you know, or team, then they want to know. They just need to understand how that it needs to be fed to them in the right way and at the right time, and you know, and with hopefully with solutions. But I hear it all the time, the same thing. Like, if only this, you know, if only they'd listen.
It's really hard, you know. We do part of my work is doing turnaround stuff, sometimes with factories in the north of England. You know, manufacturing plants and things, and many of them have people who've been working there all their life, you know, who are great people and sort of almost dedicated, of course, but quite sort of, you know, stuck in their thinking, and they just see the people upstairs as, you know, the gaffers or the, whatever they call them, you know, the governors or the boss up there, and there's so little connection between them. And then very often that you get this sort of raft of middle managers who are trying like hell to do their best, but they're being sort of interfered with people, you know, from another country who may own the business, and you get all this crazy stuff going on, and then you get this piggy in the middle at the top who's trying to pull all the strings of everything, and everything's nothing's happening. And we're lucky because we can go in and shake things up a bit in the nicest way,
come in and politely tell them maybe turn it back to basics.
Yeah. It's a bit like, I don't know if you remember those Columbo programs. There was an American detective.
The detective one. Yeah, of course.
You had this old raincoat, you know, and you always used to make out he was really stupid. And you used to go, excuse me, but, you know, I'm looking at a dead body on the floor there, you know. I think our job as a consultant is that really, is to sort of point out in simple terms, the things, not because you're not meant to be the one who gives advice, but you just point out things that are a bit crazy.
Yeah, ask some obvious questions which nobody for some reason is asking.
They really want to do it like this. And getting empowerment going in an organization is the most exciting thing. And the first time when I left the police, we started working as consultants around, you know, trying to get organizations really flying. And we did some really exciting work in the early stages, and we had phenomenal success. And I remember thinking, what am I doing here in this manufacturing plant making tractors? You know, I've just been a policeman in London, you know, or a senior policeman also, you know, involved with it. And what do I know? But it was the not knowing that was just fantastic, because it was a great venture for me. And we used to take our job very seriously. I mean, it sounds frivolous, but it's not. But we could just ask questions that nobody would normally ask, you know, because we're so so fascinating for us.
Well, I love that. And I love that about you. And I have to say, you know, I got the opportunity to come to the Lake District with you about 5 years ago now. I was looking it up. It seems not that long ago, but 5 years ago, we went to the Lake District and I got to see you at work with a team of people on a leadership development course. And I think it's that, I mean, to credit you here, one of the things I think is amazing about you and something that does inspire me and is that inquisitive nature, that eagerness to learn more. And I actually knew your dad as well. I was very young. So I was inspired by him too, but I know that he had the same thing, that same kind of inquisitive interest, and that just it radiates. And in fact, your family, who I know quite well as well, they all seem to have fed off it. So, you know, I think it's a fantastic trait. And I don't know if it's something that's always, you know, that's consciously going on in your head, but it certainly, for me, it's certainly something that I've found if I try and take that approach, if I'm always trying to be, you know, trying to find out more, trying to learn more, trying to understand more about a situation, it becomes interesting and you can generate this sort of passion for things which you never thought you'd find passion for. You're suddenly interested in, you know, oh wow, this is this manufacturing plant, you know, how does this thing tick over, you know, what is this? And that interest in life. So I think for me, that's, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's probably where your inquisitive nature and also your sort of challenging nature has then spilled over into all these adventures, which we should really address. You flung over the adventures, and I think we need to do, I mean, 100%, anyone who hasn't read John's book, I mean, I'm assuming not that many people are going to listen to this to start with, and maybe if this podcast gets anywhere, more people will listen, and in which case, read John's book. But if you haven't read John's book, you really should, because it is amazing, and it's amazing. It's basically a full breakdown of a complete adventurer's life, and it's incredible. But let's talk about a few of them. So one thing I haven't asked you, which I'd like to know, is what's your favorite adventure that you've done and why?
Interesting. I kind of loved all of them in their own way. The one thing they all have in common is and the most of the sports, I mean, the Himalayas was fantastic, but you know, I was kind of younger then, very fit and fast, and that was so exciting because we got trapped on a ridge, in a very perilous very perilous position at about, I don't know, was it 6,500 meters or something, and it really looked like we weren't going to come down. And I was with a sports psychiatrist, or sports psychologist, and he was a great climber, by the way. He was a far better climber than I was, and he was brilliant. And there were only four of us up there, and we're sort of stuck. And we tried to put this tent up on this perilous little ledge, and we're kind of stuck there. And the next day, the storm raged, and sugar, you know, we put this kind of other little tent alongside, because the two younger guys with us were kind of struggling. We're all struggling. This little, worried the whole time we were going to fall off because we were just, you know, on the patch. And in the doing of this, you know, people started getting frostbite in their fingers, and the two young guys particularly got, one guy got nine black fingers, and you know, the other guy got five fingers out of action. So and we're sat there thinking, Jesus, how are we going to get off here? If ever the weather stops and it warms up, we're all going to fall off because we're kind of on this little nest.
Slide down. You
know? So I hope it doesn't warm up too quick. But you know, we can't live any longer because we were doing what they call an alpine dash up this thing. Very lightweight, moving fast. So it's 1,000 meters or whatever it was. And it was kind of, you know, and it's ice climbing the whole way. Snow and ice climbing. Well, snow, it's mainly snow. And eventually the weather changed. We thought, and these guys are looking really desperate, these two young guys. Can you imagine with their black fingers? And so then the thought was, well, okay, what we'll do, we'll put their gloves on, we'll bind them, their axes, their ice axes, onto their arms so that they're like kind of hammer man, you know. So they can, and they were going to have to be like that for 12 hours. You know, they were going to have to climb down for 12 hours down this thing, not take them off. And there's a fabulous, what's that film with John Cleese, where they I guess one of the crazy films here is where he ends up in a monk's outfit. I don't know if you remember it. Top clockwise or something like that. Yeah, clockwise.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he ends up in this thing and he's lying on the floor and it's all going wrong and the car drives off. He's just about to get there and he sits there with this girl and he goes, "Oh, Laura, you know, it's not the despair that gets you. It's not the despair, it's the hope." You know, I just love that clip, and I love it because that's what gets you. And my job, and you know, the job of the leader, is to keep the hope alive for people
without ever letting up. Yeah,
absolutely. And so, you know, if you look at the really great leaders, people like Ernest Shackleton, who led his team across the ice when their ship got stuck in the ice. It's a wonderful story, which I think most people would be aware of. And he did that for over a year. He kept this little band of people going, so they all survived, all 50 of them survived in the most perilous of circumstances. And he's always been my role model. You know, I just think if I could be like him, it'd be wonderful. But it's somehow easier for me, because very often if I go, you know, if I go to the desert, the jungle, whatever it is, I'm usually leading. So, but I make sure there's someone better than me. I don't know anything. What do I know about? I don't know anything about the desert. I don't know anything about rowing the Olympic. But, you know, that was a difficult one because I was with one other person. So imagine here, rowing boat. What is it? I don't know, 10 meters long or maybe less. I'm not sure what it was. And you're stuck for 9.5 weeks with one person in a rowing boat. And so when he starts to go wonky, it gets really tricky.
I remember you telling a story. I'm not sure if you want to tell this, but I remember you telling me a story about calling back home on the satellite phone that you weren't supposed to use very much because it was very, you know, very sensitive. You had limited batteries and things, and you called home to your wife because your partner started acting up a bit and you weren't sure what to do. And do you want to tell that story, give a bit more context to why you were calling Elaine?
I said, you know, you see, and my great buddy, if he was here, he'd tell you the story, but he was feeling very depressed. It was a pretty depressing thing. You know, we were in the middle of bloody nowhere and not getting anywhere. You know, it was gradually creeping across towards Barbados from Africa. Never. And it wasn't made any very clever by the fact that when the route we took, we didn't really know what we were doing quite. I think we might have been a lot more sensible if we researched it a bit more before we set off. But the whole bunch of other people were setting off. And to be honest, as we went down the African coast, at some point we had to turn right and go across to America. And we were never quite sure what that would be. And someone said, we'll go down to Cape Verde and, you know, go west. There, you know, we got down there, we were going so fast. And we're thinking, my goodness me, you know, we're doing really well, we're way ahead of it, Russ. And suddenly the owner of the boat rang up at the satellite phone and said, what the hell are you guys doing? I said, we're doing really well, actually, we're kind of right up front. He says, yeah, that's because you're going in the wrong bloody direction. We're going, what do you mean we're going in the wrong direction? Oh, God, you've gone far too far south. You know, and I said, do you think we'll make it to Barbados? He said, highly unlikely. So I was going, so where do you think we'll end up? He goes, Venezuela. I was going, okay. So I come off the phone and say to my buddy, he's going, what's happening? And I said, well, apparently we've gone too far south. He's going, oh, we're doomed. I'm going, no, God, yeah, just trust me. And he says, oh, God, where are we going to end up then? I said, Venezuela. He said, Venezuela? I said, yeah, well, I mean, sooner or later, we'll bump into Venezuela. He said, yeah, exactly, bump into Venezuela. We're going to die. I said, no, Casey, you might just end up on a beautiful sandy beach, you know, and people bring you pina coladas and it. You know, there for a few weeks, it'll be wonderful, you know. And he's going, oh, we got doomed, you know. Oh, God. So I had to ring up my wife and, you know, can you help us find a way back to me? Because she had access to all the websites and work.
Well, a key piece of it, I'm going to interrupt you because a key piece of information you've forgotten here, and this is actually context to anyone watching, including family members, to bear in mind that technology, that like everyone's probably thinking that, oh, when you just look on your phone, like you would Google Maps, right? This was pre-Google Maps, right? I mean, this was like, that wasn't the thing. Plus, internet connection out on the Atlantic wasn't there in the way it would be now. And I believe you turned up, you did have a GPS system, but you turned up to the leaving point, right? And there was a story around that, if I'm not right. That you had the UK map on the system, but not anywhere else.
Your listeners are going to think, what a chump this guy is. Don't listen to his bloody advice, for God's sake. Disaster. We've both been on courses, you know, by the Royal Ocean and Yachting Association. And I thought he'd done the GPS bit, you know, because we made assumptions are so dangerous. You know, it was absolutely bloody not. So just as we're about to go off, he said, John, do you know how to use the GPS? I said, no, do you know how to? He said, no. So I said, oh, Christ, well, I've got one here. So I'm fiddling around and I couldn't get it to work. So eventually there's a guy on the shore who seemed to know. He said, I said, can you do a favor, look at this thing? He said, and he's playing with it half an hour. And they're going, you're leaving in 30 minutes, you know, because it was kind of meant to be a race. I mean, God, we weren't going to race anymore. But so we're leaving in 20 minutes, you know, this guy's, eventually he throws it back to us and said, I think you had it on British Grid or something. well, we meant to have it on. Oh, for God's sake, he's going, I think it's right. I said, fine. So we put it down. And Fraser said, well, let's get on the lineup. Quick, come on, let's line up with everybody else, you know? So we're all lined up the thing. He said, which way are we going to go? I said, follow everybody else, Brace.
Exactly the advice you want before a 10-week, what was it, 9-10 weeks rowing?
Yeah, we set off 3,000 miles. I think I was maybe intending that day. The other thing was that you really need to get very well organized to do these things. One thing I've learned, if I could advise anybody listening to this, you know, if you're going to do something like row the Atlantic, do get yourself organized, okay? I thought I was really well organized. And we were just setting off, and we'd only got one little stove on a gimbal, that's all we got. 9.5 weeks to cook the water, boil the water to go in the dehydrated food. And we got a kettle that was going to be staunch and that was going to keep us going. Unfortunately, we left it in the flat, you know, departure point. And it wasn't until kind of the first evening, I said, Fraser, did you bring that kettle? He said, oh God, I thought you got it, you know. Oh, sugar, no, what are we going to do? And all we could find was one little spare kettle, which was like from Woolworths, you know, this little
that is the kettle, right? That traveled across the Atlantic with you.
That's all we had to cook our water to go across the Atlantic for 9.5 weeks, you know.
I love it.
Not a good idea, folks. Just, you know. So, you know, for those of you who have listened to this, who've actually done work around personality profiles, you'll understand that there are different halves of the brain, you know. And some are smarter than the other.
Well, I think that brings it round nicely too, because it is one of the reasons I think. So the last chapter of the book I'm going to write, I'm in the process of writing, is Be Brave and Execute. And the theme really is around this, like at some point you have to, if you're going to win something or achieve that goal or live that dream, at some point you have to say, I'm going to do it now. Like now I press the on switch. Now I row the first, you know, or put the oars in the water and go, or I'm heading up this hill now, you know, I'm going up this mountain and now we're doing it, you know, and taking that first step in, like knowing it has begun, like going into the competition or getting into the business meeting or going into negotiation, whatever it is, like that moment when you take that step, that is being brave and executing. And there's a whole ton of stuff that comes behind that, which is all around preparation and practice and skills development, knowing what skills and talents you need to execute the strategy you have. And I think you're doing yourself a little bit of a disservice because there's so much other stuff that had gone into preparing all of that. And of course, mistakes happen. And I think one of the key learnings is like, be brave and execute, because no matter what, something's going to go wrong or something's going to need to adapt and change in your strategy. And if you think about winning teams in sport, you know, like it's a constant evolution of changing and adapting strategy based on what's coming at you and what the defenses are doing or what the other team's doing in attack, etc. So all of that stuff is adaption. And your kettle story is beautiful because it's adapting. Oh shit, we need a bloody kettle. This is what we got. Okay, we'll make it work. You're still sitting here alive after that and having achieved it. And I think for me that courage is a very important factor into achieving all of that. And so if you could speak a little bit around sort of your philosophy of courage. I was going to ask you first your philosophy of winning, but actually now I'd like to ask you your philosophy of sort of courage. Yeah. Where do you think that stems from? Are you born naturally courageous? I know you started, the first thing you said actually on this was you know, I wasn't born courageous, and my dad sent me to boarding school to sort of kick it into me, but being on it, I mean, and maybe that was honest, I'm sure, but like if really digging a little deeper, like where did it stem from? Was it, you know, because you were in the armed forces and you were in the police, faced, I mean, I think when in the police was when you were faced with the most sort of aggression, if I'm not wrong, from what you were describing.
Yes.
Was it there, or was it the first time you climbed in the Himalayas, or was it, you know, was it some other moment? I know you've rode around the UK, you've done all sorts of crazy stuff, like, you know, you've done some incredible experiences. Yeah. Where did it stem from, and how do you think about others being courageous and how they can tap into that courage?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Good. I think the Himalayas were very developmental for me, because it was, I'd done many, many expeditions, jungles and God knows what, you know, but I'd always had sort of like the army behind me or whatever it was. Or even in the police, we've always got a bunch of people there working with you, you know, can help you. The Himalayas, it was, you know, leadership can be very lonely. And when you're having to pick teams, you know, leave people out, it's tough. And then the team you pick, you've got to keep them fired up and, you know, up for stuff really. And so I think that was really kind of significant for me. But the crucial thing I think really about the courage is your capacity to handle uncertainty and change, because, you know, particularly in what's happening in the, around at the moment, I don't have to talk about that. It's you know, it's all over the shop at the moment. But the people that I'm working with now, some of them are really thriving. And I know guys who've absolutely shot on through this period of time. And for them, it's their dream. It's their dream time, you know, because everybody else is in chaos, everyone throwing their hands up saying you can't do it. And they're just saying, I'm going to do it. And you can spot it in things like the restaurants and, you know, the cafes, the ones who are up for it. Of course, you've got, you know, they're taking proper precautions, but they're up for the challenge. And I think our, you know, so in terms of courage, our job is to instill courage in the people that we work with. And actually, the only way you can do that is making them, A, feel that they're really, really part of a team that is so exciting to be in. That's the first thing. Yeah. And you only ever recruit people who are up for a challenge. The good, I'm working with some great people from companies like Salesforce, KPMG, and believe you me, the ones that are really flying are the ones who are very careful about who they recruit. They recruit like-minded people who are up for an adventure. Yeah. And they're patterned, they work hard, they play hard. And they inspire them. They inspire people to go along with them and make it happen, you know?
Yeah.
So I think in terms of courage, there are several bits of courage. Partly is your ability to be able to somehow get the energy of your passion in a consistent way off to, you know, to into the minds of others, which is kind of critical. But also at the same point is to manage your own brain, which is bonkers at times, you know, and you're thinking, you know, how can I stay steady? And it's all, everything's piling at you from all directions. And so it's being able to kind of push off some of the dross. And, you know, and coping strategies are critical. One of the things I've learned in the Atlantic is that, you know, if you can pick up the right coping strategies and you can focus, you'll be fine. But, you know, part of that is getting the job done and staying calm and getting getting crystal clear about what you're doing.
Yeah.
But the other thing is about the emotional focus. How can you control the emotions of your mind, and how can you stop the gremlins, you know, getting into you and sort of, you know, digging deep into your brain the seeds of doubt. And,
so actually, I'm going to pause you there and ask you, what do you find helps you in that sense? Because I was telling someone about you today and how excited I was to do this and start this podcast and interview my Uncle John, and I was telling him all about you, and he said you got to ask him if he meditates, and I didn't know how to put that into the questions because I didn't know that about you, and I don't know that about you, but I figure there's a calm John somewhere in there, like, and there's a John that is very leveled. I mean, I know you well enough to know you have that, but like, what are your own coping strategies that you use, and what are the things you go to really ground yourself?
Okay, good. That's a really good question. Okay, let me take you back to the time that when I was running this police station in Stoke Newington, and I realized when I came back from the Himalayas, when eventually I kind of managed to get off this mountain and get everybody back alive, which is something of a bloody miracle. I kind of knew I was going to have to pay the price for it. You know, there was going to be a price to pay. When I got back, the guy who'd been running the police station had had a really bad time, and he'd gone off sick, and I took over from him and went on to run the place beyond that. But I went into it like with a missionary zeal. So I said to my wife, Elaine, I said, I won't be home very much. So I think what we might have to do is put the boys into boarding school, because for the next year or 18 months, I will spend, a bit like a missionary, I'll spend most of my time at work. Mm. Now, I would not suggest to anyone that they should do that. You know, probably the opposite, actually. But that was just happened to be the way I knew if I was going to do it, it had to be 120%. Nothing else like that was going to have to be around. I had to really get the guys galvanized to do what they were going to do. And that put enormous focus, enormous pressure on our marriage. So, of course, I ended up with these crazy two things going on. One was that we had, we go to a therapist to try and rescue our marriage, because my wife was going demented with me going to the Himalayas and nearly being killed and then coming back and getting all sorts of crazy shit in Hackney. You know?
Asking what's next as well on the adventure list.
Yeah. I was kind of, you know, that was so well, but I was constantly had the therapist saying, you know, kind of let the anger out. And at the same time, I was going to someone from the organization called the Brahma Kumaris, who are a peace group, and they taught me to meditate. They took me in and taught me to meditate. Really? So they would say, John, be peaceful, you know, get rid of that anger. It's like this kind of yin and yang going on with this kind of crazy mix of stuff. You know, so, but they, what they taught me, I never forgot. And there have been many times where I will use that meditation. Is whoever's speaking is absolutely on the button. If I'm going in to see a major client in PwC or wherever it is, and I'm waiting, and it's a really important meeting, because I really want to engage with them, I want to make sure we get the best shot and doing some work with them, if it's the kind of work we want to do. Mm-hmm. Before I go in, I will prepare myself. So, you know, I will kind of stand up against the wall, and I press my back into the wall, and I will soak up the energy from the building of all the good people who've been there, and it kind of infuses me with such an energy. By the time they say, okay, Mr. Beck, you can go in now, I go, boff, I'm in that room thinking, dang, right, come on, what are we going to do, you know? And so I do, yes, I do fill myself up, you know, and I think we have to. The difficulty is, you know, it's like if you go in a car to drive up the motorway from north to south, south to north, whatever, you start with a full tank of petrol, but if you've got to refuel it somewhere.
Yeah.
And otherwise you just run out. Now I'm lucky because the work I do, and I often work flat out, but the work I do gives me such a buzz that I can refill. You know, as far as I give it out, I get back. So I get huge buzz from seeing people change and seeing organization and teams change. But it's not always like that. You know, we get to dross times where you have to do all sorts of things that are boring and not kind of exciting and testing and demanding.
Talk to accountants and things.
Oh, yeah, we've got to, you know, we've got to put up with disappointments and things that don't happen and COVID and this and that. So I think for me, if whatever, probably the best advice I would give is, there was a good friend of mine called Tom Moriarty who ran a stress clinic in Dublin for quite a long time. And like all good people from Southern Ireland, he was a very charismatic guy, and I loved him. He had a huge influence on me. And I did a lot of work with him. And he would say, you know, when you come back from work, you've got to be careful because you get kind of drained out. And he used to get a lot of people completely kind of burnt out who come to him, business people typically, who were in the state. And so he would start by saying, okay, let's look at the different, I used to describe, he didn't use the word, the piano keys of your life. Yeah. And you'll know, Nick, as a coach, that you have different elements of your life. You know, you have sport, you have this, you have, for some people, spirituality, you have kind of music, whatever it is, you know, you have family, friends, you know, what else. And you also have work. And what happens to us is that we end up beep, 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 just pressing that one key, work, 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 which eventually the petrol runs out.
Yeah.
Unless you're lucky enough to have a normal spout coming back. And if you're not, then you're going to get burnt out.
Yeah.
So what he did was to get them working the keys again. So that they would, he said, we're not going to talk about work. You know, we're going to talk about what you're going to do about getting fit. And this needs to set more little challenges. Eventually they get all the keys going. And then they buzz and he said, okay, now let's talk about work and get back to work and change things.
I love that. And I totally agree. And it's very interesting to me, especially the times we live in now, a lot of young people are being persuaded, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. And there's people talking about millennials as though they're entitled and they've got this, you know, but they've grown up being told they can do whatever they want to do. And then they're told they're entitled when they think maybe I could actually do that. And then I think a lot of the people influencing, you know, the big influencers of business and stuff are, you know, they're a lot of them, like Elon Musk, for example, genius minds, you know, incredible minds with incredible capacity. And they're working ridiculously long hours. But a bit like to what you've just said, I think, you know, they get their energy back from that work. And that's often a fairly unique situation that you find that, you know, a lot of people working in the supermarket, you know, being a checkout, probably don't get their energy back from doing that job day in, day out. And so it's so important you find that. And I think at every level, understanding yourself and understanding better and better about what makes you tick, what gives you that energy, and how do you tap into that energy, and how do you make sure you're allowing yourself to tap into that energy is extremely, extremely important. And I mean, I'm a dad of two little girls, and they are the most incredible little people I could possibly have imagined. And I'm so grateful for them. However, they're also the most incredible energy sappers you could ever imagine, you know, like just getting them out the door in the morning, you know, and trying to get them fed and dressed and out the door with a pair of socks on each, you know, and properly clothed. Like, it's an absolute, you know, you're completely exhausted when you get to work. And I'm sure, and the reason I say that, I'm sure I'm not alone amongst any peers of mine that might watch this, you know. But again, it's allowing yourself the time and the opportunity to just breathe. And for me, I find it good to run. I mean, that's a big one for me. It is kind of my meditation moment, because I'm also doing something good for my machine and keeping the machine running. And, you know, like hopefully getting this thing in good shape for old age. But whatever it may be, it's so important that people understand it. And I do believe that people are more and more getting into that mindset. You know, you have apps now, mindfulness and all these kind of you know, great apps that people are using, and a lot more people are going to the gyms and stuff. But it is so important to know also why you're doing it, and that is what you've just said, is to get that energy, like get that energy back. And I love what you said about leaning against the wall and picking up the energy from people. It's such a spiritual concept, and I know you are quite spiritual in that way, but it's also not religious at all, which you mentioned about people having their faith and things. And I think that's also interesting, for when people have faith, they have that, they can tap into that energy, and that's fine. That's great. Right. I mean, but it's just, it's what is it? What is it that makes you tick? I
think also, Nick, I'm just thinking that, you know, it really is important that we care about what we're doing.
Yeah.
And whatever that means to you. You know, it. We really need to feel we're engaged in whatever we're doing, whatever work we're doing. And that's really hard sometimes, because you get to a certain stage in your career where you're stuck in some, you know, hole, and you can't get out because you need money for your, you know, to pay the bills. But you desperately want to get out and work somewhere else. You work with someone who's not the kind of person you want to work for. Yeah. It's far from inspiring. In fact, they're sapping energy from you rather than giving it to you. And they're giving you no headroom, and you go, oh, that, you know. And it's very easy for me to sit here and say, get out. And I know it's difficult. Yeah. But if I was to give one message, I would say, be very careful when you go for a job. You interview the person who's going to be working, and you interview them in a polite and respectful way. And if you've got any doubts at all about that person, don't do it. Because most of the people I'm coaching, the biggest problem they've got is the person they're working for.
Yeah. Yep.
Who has no insight, doesn't have any empathy.
Yeah.
And you're stuck with it every day. And of course, we spend more time at work than doing anything else. Why should we spend most of our living day working for someone who quite clearly doesn't have the same value as us? They may be brilliant, whatever it is, but they're not like us.
Yeah.
So it's very,
More often than not, I mean, that goes back to my manage your manager thing, because more often than not, that's also, I haven't got anywhere close to the same experience as you in coaching, but the coaching I have done, and I have done a fair amount, it's very similar story. You know, it's nearly always about like, how do I make this happen? And it's usually talking about someone above them or in some position of power that they need to influence. And I think it is so important. And again, I go back to it. Or I always say, like, understanding yourself and how that is working for you or not working for you is a key moment, but then also managing that situation. But I agree, you know, in taking on a job, finding that passion. And I think one thing I mentioned it already, but I know I'm good at it as well, is finding passion in things that you didn't realize you were going to find passion, like trying to be interested in stuff that you didn't think you were interested in. That's often a good way to suddenly start realizing, oh, well, actually, this is quite interesting. And this person who's been doing this for 60 years or whatever it is, you know, in the same role, but you'd think they were really boring, but actually they're really interesting and they have so much insight to the industry or the whatever it is. So tapping into the interest factor as well helps with that.
Definitely.
Passion and generating your own interest around it. And I guess a key thing to also say is not every day is going to be all fun and dancing and enjoying every moment of life, right? I mean, you even said it yourself, you know, you're in a very fortunate position to be enjoying the work you're doing and have worked in a really great company that you've run for, what is it, 25 years now or something, or maybe even longer. I don't want to date you too much, but you know, the thing that you've done is chase down those passions, but I'm sure you still have miserable days where you're like, oh, this is such, you know, like,
and
that happens, but then also that makes those highs that much better, I guess.
Yeah. The other thing I think, you know, I was thinking as we were talking, I think it's having the courage to push back sometimes. And we tend to hesitate to do that sometimes. I think sometimes we hesitate too long. I remember at a critical point working for a senior guy at Scotland Yard, and we were, you know, I was in a top leadership position at this particular point in wherever what we were doing. But he was a great guy, but psychometrically we were diametrically opposite. You know, whatever measure you want to talk about, he was one thing and I was the other. And it was an absolute nightmare with this guy. And eventually I just had to let fly and tell him just what I thought. And, you know, I thought he was going to sack me, but he was just wonderful. He was just great. And he changed dramatically. And we went on to both do, I think it was Myers-Briggs or whatever it was we did at the time, and got to understand the difference. And I became incredibly fond of him. He taught me so much. He taught me all the things I didn't know, you know, and there was a hell of a lot I didn't know. And when I came to leave the organization, he was the one guy I wanted my leading to.
Yeah.
He was the opposite to me, but I loved him, you know. And it's only because I pushed back that he respected me. Otherwise, I think he probably thought I was a bit of a twat and didn't really...
You're absolutely right. And well, so
it's hard to do, you know.
There's a personality trait around agreeableness, right? And some people are more agreeable than others, and tends to be that if you're not as agreeable, you're probably better at things like sales and you know, hard negotiations and things, because you're willing to push back. But for people who are agreeable, I'm definitely in the agreeable category. I think you probably are as well, by what you've just described. It's difficult to push back, and it's very difficult to decide to take that risk. But I mean, for someone who is less agreeable and perhaps more comfortable in that zone, they're probably gonna, like you've just said, they're probably gonna respect you more for that. And that's it's really interesting. I think, I mean, we've gone, I think the courage factor, we've also now touched on like personal courage to take your own steps forward in just moving forward towards a goal. And I love that as well. I mean, as I said to you, I don't really have a super agenda for our talk, but I love that we talk about courage, because I think just sweeping back now to you and your adventures, because I think there's putting yourself outside your comfort zone and perhaps having a difficult conversation, you know, even not necessarily with your boss, but just taking on a difficult conversation. For some people, that is terrifying. Yeah. You know, just they don't like conflict. They don't want to address that. But then there's the other end of the scale, which is deciding to, you know, hop in a boat and row across the Atlantic for 10 weeks, 2 hours on, 2 hours off row, or running the Marathon des Sables in the Sahara Desert, for those that don't know. And John did it when you were 60, was it? Were you 60 years
old? Yeah.
Unbelievable. It's like a 5-day marathon. Like every day's a marathon. It's ridiculous. And one thing I wanted to touch on there, you one of your stories that you told me, which I want you to tell, is one that inspired me so much. Because when we think of winning or achieving goals, or you know, whatever you want to frame that as, when we think of that achievement factor, it's not always obvious what the win is. And again, as I've mentioned, part of my book is talking about define your win, you know, understand your game, define your win. And you encapsulated defining win with the story, which I know you're going to know what I mean if I say swimming pool. So if I can pass that over to you and then get you to tell the story, because I absolutely love that story.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. I mean, the reason I decided to do that, I was running an assessment center, some people who were going to the North Pole, and we were trying to work out whether people were suitable or not. So part of that was to work out they'd done things in terms of endurance before. And one of the guys who we were interviewing had clearly done a lot of stuff, and he was a young chap, and he was saying, well, I've just come back from the Marathon des Sables. I was going, oh, what's that? And he said, well, you do 6 marathons in 7 days. I'm going, oh my God, where? He said, the middle of the Sahara Desert. What? And you carry all your kit. And it's 40 degrees. I was going, and he says, it's the toughest foot race on earth. I was going, oh my God, it's amazing, man. Well, you'll definitely be great in the North Pole. No problem. So I went back and was sort of typing into the, you know, the internet, Marathon des Sables. And it said, you know, toughest foot race on earth. I was going, sure, I've got to do that. So I put the deposit down and into the kitchen and said to my wife, I'm going to do a running thing. And she said, what sort of running thing? I was just kind of a marathon thing. She said, John, when's the last time you did a marathon? I said, oh, it wasn't that long ago. She said, 20 years ago. 20 years ago? How are you going to do a marathon? So was like, she won at 6. And she's going, I can't believe this. You're crazy. And so I trained hard at this thing. But it was pretty daunting. I knew it was going to be daunting. So I had to think, well, what, you know, there's no way I'm going to win this thing. But, you know, I didn't really want to come last. But I just had to make sure I got through every day. And as long as I got through every day, that was all right, because eventually I could get through it. Then we got to the point where I thought, okay, kind of, what am I going to do? So as we're on the plane going out there, all the British contingent, we're all being briefed by some geezer who's kind of running the show. And you say, and of course, you know, when you get to the hotel, you know, make sure that you go for a swim in the swimming pool in this place in the middle of, you know, Morocco or whatever it is, this hotel, because when you come back, you won't be able to swim. And I was going, oh, why can't you swim? Oh, because you'll have blisters, and you can't have blisters in the pool. And I was going, okay. So I kind of went away quietly. And when nobody was listening, I went, excuse me. So, if I don't have blisters, will I be able to swim? Well, you will have blisters. I said, but imagine if I don't. He said, well, you have to get a doctor's note from me. I was going, all right, okay, yeah, that's fine, thanks. So my goal then became how not to get blisters. How can I do the marathon without getting blisters? So I won't bore you with the procedure, because I can tell you it was very complicated. I spoke to everybody, you know, beforehand about kind of, you know, everybody who'd done it. I said, you know, what's the biggest thing? They said blisters. So I said, what did you do? And I found four or five people who'd done it, who hadn't got blisters. So I listened to everything they did, you know, and sure enough, I got through this ordeal, which was tough. Honestly, guys, I tell you, the Marathon des Sables, if you get a chance to do it. But it is really tough. It is the toughest foot race on earth, without a shadow of doubt. It's a nightmare. But, you know, very exciting when you, because you've got to be careful. These camels come up behind them, and if they overtake you, you come up, they take you out of the race. So you've got to keep looking behind you. And when we got to the end of this thing, the day after, and, you know, you imagine we had loads of beers the night before. You know, we all go, and I get up at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I kind of go down to the pool, and everyone's lying out on their sun loungers, you know. And I just go, yes, into the water. Yes.
I love it.
And swam up like that. Poor devil was looking at me going, what's he doing? You know, I was going, yeah, come on. So I think we have to define our own goals. You know, we have to do things that excite us, get us interested in, that we feel capable of doing, you know. And
I love it. It's such an inspiring story, because it's like the goal was, of course, to finish it, but you weren't bothered about racing anyone. You were bothered about my feet and not getting taken out of the race. That's it. And it's a big one. Oh my God. I love it. I love that story. I love it. And the one other thing I wanted to sort of say was, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the challenges that didn't go to plan, and maybe even some of the things you ended up shelving, because being brave and executing, of course, means sometimes you need to understand when you shouldn't execute and you shouldn't go ahead and do it either yet or ever. And I know you have a few examples of times where you've perhaps shelved an idea or even abandoned an idea. And I was sort of wondering around that a little bit, because when do you decide not to execute? Like, you're still brave, but we're not going to go for this.
Well, you know, there are things. I mean, the one that comes to mind, I was maybe, you know, 5 years ago or something, that whenever it was, when the Tour de France were going through the UK, and they all came through by the village, not far from where I live in Essex. And I watched this, I was standing on the side of the road, I saw this peloton of these cool, good, cool dudes come through, you know, on their bikes. I was thinking, this is so cool. That's amazing. And I was standing outside a cycle shop at the time. I was thinking, oh my God, you know, this is so cool. And I've got a bike, but I've never really done much cycling. I'm rubbish at cycling, but, and I hate cycling really. So I thought the toughest thing for me to do would be to do a long distance cycle ride. So I went home and I said to my wife, I've just been watching this thing, and very inspirational. And she was going, yeah, what are you saying? I'm going, well, I just want to do a really long cycle. I think I ought to. And she's saying, John, you're rubbish at cycling. I said, no, but that's the point. That's what, you know, if anything is possible, I really ought to do it. And she said, you'll be a liability. I said, no, it's fine. So I've got my bike out, and I get it all sorted, you know, and it's not a brilliant bike. It didn't cost much, but it kind of got all the bits on. And I then started ringing people up and saying, look, I want to go from Land's End to John O'Groats on a cycle ride. Will you come and join me? And one by, these were guys who'd been to the North Pole with me. And one by one, they said, I effing hate cycling. But, well, that's why we should do it, though. And they were saying, why would you want to do something that you hate? I said, because that's the ultimate challenge. So they said, oh, God, all right, one by one. So we got about four of us all lined up to do this Land's End John O'Groats cycle ride. And I'm out now training in the morning, you know, frosty morning. I'm out with my mate, Big John, and he's behind me. And we're going through this little narrow village in Essex where it gets very narrow. And the pavement's very narrow. And my men are going about 5 miles an hour, 4x4 just quietly kind of moves alongside. So I think, Jesus, nowhere to go. And I clipped into the pedals, which I'm never very good at, you know, I'm quite mastered it.
Well, you're practicing.
I think, I need to get off here. And I wobbled. The next thing, boof, I fell sideways straight through the windows of a curry house. Can you imagine anything? I'm now kind of half stuck with this window. Fortunately, it was a sort of a plastic window or something. So I'm now stuck in the window. And my mate's sort of dragging me out. And he's laughing so much he nearly fell over, this guy. And he's in hysterics. And then he said, you're all right. I said, yeah. Said, shit, John, my arm feels a bit funny. He said, your shoulder looks weird. So I had to sort of clunk this thing back in. And I ended up having an operation. So all the guys who I'm training with said, okay, John, we'll put it back a year. I said, no, we'll go ahead. You know. We'll do it this year, but I'll be your backup team, you know. So they all went ahead and did it. Every one of them, right up to the end, you know. I'd say, are you going to like this yet? I still hate it, John. I still hate it. when we finished it, I got all these videos of one by one of people wheeling their bikes away, having bought these 4,000-pound bikes off, you know, whatever it was. And I was going, And so, you know, believe you me, in terms of capability, I will never, ever go on a cycling challenge again. In fact, my wife went cycle down to the shops. You know? So the answer is, yeah, of course, actually. And there are many things I wouldn't do. I mean, you know, I'm not, I go down a cave. I don't like it at all. I wouldn't want to go slithering.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And I'm sure there are lots of things I would, you know, wouldn't do, you know. So, but you just have to know what excites you really and what tickles your fancy. I like to do things people haven't done before. If you can, you know, if you like me, decide to row from London to Paris because I discovered maybe you'd done it before. But the Romans must have done it every other weekend.
Yeah, but you did it in a whaling boat, right?
Yeah, right.
You guys did it. Was that when you were in the police or?
I was in. You know, going up the Seine, you know, on a sort of holiday thing, just around there. And I just looked across, thought, yeah, wouldn't it be fun to row up there from England, you know, from London? And I just thought, that would be great if we could make this happen, you know. And my wife's going, don't do it, John, do it.
Romantic. Romantic moment in Paris and you're planning an adventure.
Yeah. No. It was just kind of a great adventure, you know. It was a wonderful adventure. But there you go, you know. It's just, and nobody had done it before. Well, there's nothing on the anyway. People went on to do it afterwards, you know. And they beat our record. But so I like to do things that are a bit kind of chancy and a bit, you know, new and stuff. And I particularly love taking other people. Even now, I take people off to the desert every year and do crazy stuff with them, you know, climb mountains and do stuff.
Yeah, I guess we should probably touch on that as well, because I think part, you know, related to business as well and challenges, you know, you mentioned you get that energy back from seeing people grow and seeing people take on challenges, but you actually have made also a business out of it, and you've done a lot of things for charity and a lot of, you know, really great outreach work and things, and I know you took a lot of people who perhaps would never have come near those sort of challenges away. Do you want to speak to that a little bit? I mean, perhaps around the courage for them as well, and how they respond to those moments.
Yeah, I kind of went through a phase where, you know, I was desperate really to put something back, and I was approached by someone a long time after I left the police who was doing some work with gangs or wanted some work around gun and knife crime. About 10 years ago, we had the last spike. And so I said, come on, why don't we try and find the youth workers, the ex-gang people, who, you know, take them away to remote Scottish Island and do some stuff with them. And we would take, you know, 12 or 18 of them away, off, you know, out of London. Many of them hadn't had the chance to be out of their borough before, and some of them just hadn't been off their estate really very much, probably because they'd been knifed or something. They did, you know, and we took them away and did some wonderful stuff with them, and they were such an inspiration to me, and they were people who had a great depth to them very often. Often very good business people because they were good drug dealers and things, and they were pretty cool.
And resilient, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And only one or two of them, you know, they've been loaded with guns, and you know, they've done the whole gambit. But when you get to know them, they were hugely exciting people to work with, and it was great. It was great for us. We were really privileged to have the chance of working. I'd love to do more of that, actually. You know, that's something that really excites me, because I've just got a feeling that the people in those inner cities are really stuck, and they've just got no way out, really. And so, yeah, there's a lot of concern at the moment with the Black Lives Matter and the marches and things, which I really applaud. I think it's wonderful. But I wonder if more of us ought to, apart from going on marches, whether we really ought to get in the mix and actually make a contribution to helping people who are stuck in the inner cities, you know, helping them get experiences they wouldn't otherwise have, you know? And that, because believe me, when they're only too keen to jump out and take their lives on somewhere else, they can, but very often their options are very limited, you know?
I think I mean, as you know, I've just worked in a company for education, a company called EF Education First. I just worked for them. I worked for them for 14 years, but I've just finished working for them. So I've worked all over the place. But it's something I found inspiring there was the education component. And I believe that is a form of education in that, you know, they're getting life experience outside of their normal life. And again, that's something which, you know, a lot of people, like, you may take it for granted at times, you know, this ability to go and see other places and do things in other places. You know, you take certain parts of it for granted, for sure. I mean, I've had the incredible good fortune to travel lots and lots of countries. I've lived in 10 different countries, but I'm kind of, some of it I do definitely take for granted, because I just think about, oh, it's my life and I needed to go there for a job or whatever. But of course, it's enriched my understanding of the world and my understanding of people and different cultures and things. And that's, you know, it's made me more hungry, I suppose, to learn more, because you realize the more you travel, the more you realize what you don't know and the more you don't see. But I think when you, like you just said, for helping people who are less privileged than you or don't have the opportunities you have, that doesn't necessarily need to involve money even. It's also outreach and engagement with, you know, it's being able to do that. And certainly I think from your point there, actually it's something I'm now living in Oslo. It's something I think I'm going to try and do as well. It might well be a good way for me to learn some Norwegian as well. So I'm going to commit to that actually, John, because I like it. It's a great message. And there's certainly, you know, even though Oslo is it's a beautiful, amazing city. There are people with problems here. And so maybe I can do something to help. Who knows?
Brilliant.
I
think that's such a good
shoot for that. And any of you guys listening, if there are any people listening who aren't already doing that, yeah, let's join in. Why not? Like, I think John's laid down the gauntlet there. It's absolutely worthy of trying to help people. And, you know, regardless of your politics, because I know a lot of people right now are very upset with various politics going on in the world, and very upset with a lot of the way in which things are being communicated, and I'm also upset with things, but I think we can shove politics to the side and understand what is right and what is wrong. And there are various things where empathy for other human beings, like basic human connection, that transcends all politics, right? So
definitely. It's a great thing happening. You know, we all come out a hell of a lot wiser. You can learn so much, you know.
Well, I always, my dad died last year, the end of last year, and I'm so glad that I came to the realization in life that, you know, with age does come wisdom. And sometimes stubbornness as well, right? But wisdom, you know, sometimes, yes, people get stuck in their beliefs and stuck in their behaviors, but also just learning life along the way. And I think that is something which I really respect. And so it's one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on as well, because you have so much wisdom and so much depth of knowledge. And I think something amazing, which I really don't think you probably give yourself enough credit for, is so many of your adventures were pre-mobile phones, pre-internet. And that's going to be so difficult for a lot of young people to get their heads around. I mean, I grew up without mobile phones as well, but only until I was 18, you know. And then, like, so my first job was, there was no mobile phone. I had to go to the payphone and call up to tell them I was coming in the coach with the passengers, you know, like 45 minutes before and stuff, which is so strange to people now to imagine. But all of that happening with all of the safety components in an adventure, you know, like the adventuring without GPS, adventuring without mobile phones, adventuring without all the technical stuff they, you know, a lot of these mountaineers now have. I mean, the incredible equipment, and they should have. I'm not saying people should go out and do it without the equipment, because of course, you know, people should be as safe as possible, but it is incredible what you've achieved, John. And I think, you know, you said earlier you sort of inspired by your dad, and I think you really have done justice to that fully, and you continue to, you know. I mean, you're such an amazing energy, and your sons, you've got three sons who are all living incredible energy, and they have incredible talents, and you know, you've done an amazing job there as well, with Elaine, obviously. she gets lots of credit there as well, but you know, I think
I'm all right.
I'm so honored to have you as a uncle. I call you uncle, but yeah, cousin, second cousin, whatever it is you technically are to me, but I call you an uncle. I'm so honored. And I think I'll probably wrap up here because I really want to say a huge thank you. Thank you for being my first podcast guest. And thank you for sitting here and talking to me and sharing some of your experiences. John is tigerteams.co.uk. I'll put all the information there wherever you're looking at this, but tigerteams.co.uk is John's website. His book is Restless. He's writing a new book, but he told me not to mention that because it's not ready yet, but he's writing a new book. So we're going to hold him to that. And I'm looking forward to that book coming out. So keep your eye out for that. And yeah, thank you so much, John. It's been an absolute honor. And yeah, I love you, man.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk to you again.